Hello and welcome. My name is Nicholas Robertson and this is a podcast recorded for the Employment Lawyers Association. We thought it would be very helpful to invite both the President for the Employment Tribunals in Scotland, Judge Sona Simon, and the President for the Employment Tribunals in England and Wales, Judge Brian Doyle, to discuss the challenges faced by the tribunal system during the current pandemic. Not only did they both agree to appear, but we were able to arrange a mutually convenient time for a joint discussion of the challenges and the response by the tribunal system. We are very grateful to them both for giving up their time at this immensely busy period for them. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, and welcome to a podcast on behalf of the Employment Lawyers Association. My name's Nicholas Robertson. I'm head of the employment team at Mayor Brown and regular presenter of The View from the Mayor Brown Employment Podcast. I'm joined today, remotely of course, by Judge Sona Simon, Employment Tribunal President Scotland, and Judge Brian Doyle, Employment Tribunal President England and Wales. Judge Brian Doyle has previously been on the ELO podcast, so welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
Judge Sona Simon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being able to spare the time. This is an extremely busy and challenging time, so we are very grateful that you're able to be here today, virtually at least. The focus of the podcast is, of course, how the employment tribunal system is operating during the pandemic. And the perspective which we thought would help listeners to the podcast would be able to explain what the challenges are for the tribunal system. Those of us who've only ever been users of the service of the tribunal will not have an appreciation for where the pinch points are in the current situation. Secondly, how are the tribunals seeking to cope with that? And thirdly, and importantly, what can we, the users of the tribunal system, do to assist the tribunal? And what, for you, is the employment tribunal equivalent of inviting your friends to a barbecue on Brighton Beach this weekend? So shall we start? Let's, before we talk about how the tribunal system is coping with the pandemic, I wonder if you could identify some of the main areas where the virus is affecting the normal operation of the tribunal system. We'll all understand there'll be concerns with asking people to travel to and attend hearings, for example, but so much of the tribunal work is done behind the scenes long before the case gets to the final public hearing. Why don't we start with what I'd call the physical side of the tribunal operations? Brian, how does what we're seeing today affect tribunal offices, the staff and the tribunal judges?
Well, Nick, as you'll appreciate, there are three elements to the service that we would normally be providing to users of the employment tribunal system. That is buildings, firstly, secondly, staff, and thirdly, judges. And in terms of buildings, Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunals Service, HMCTS, took the decision a week or so ago to rationalise the number of buildings that were open for full service. And so we now have three categories of buildings. Those which are completely closed, they're not staffed, they're not open to the public. Those buildings which are not open to the public, but which remain staffed, and judiciary will very likely also be present in that second category of building. And then the third category of building, which is a building that is otherwise fully open, obviously subject to the COVID-19 regulations. Then the second category of the service that we provide involves staff. And like anybody else, the staff have been suffering the inevitable consequences of COVID-19, restrictions on their movement, ill health themselves. If they have fallen prey to the virus, they may be living in a household with a vulnerable person, and therefore an element of self-isolation is involved. All of this is affecting the ability of the Courts and Tribunal Service to fully staff the service that we provide. And that's putting to one side the difficulties that we were already having post the abolition of employment tribunal fees to properly resource the employment tribunal system. So COVID-19 has added to the challenge there. And then the third element, which is our judges. Again, like the staff, Many of them are in a situation where they may be experiencing ill health. Some of them are having to self-isolate. Others are having difficulties because of public transport issues. And the result is that many of our judges are working from home, except in circumstances where there's an agreement about rotas for example, dealing with duty. So the normal service that we provide is affected by all three of those elements: buildings, staff, and judges.
And I imagine one of the joys of the situation is it's also an ever-changing picture, particularly around staff and tribunal judges, as presumably people either fall ill or recover, or staff are able to come in or not come in. And so it's a continually changing picture.
It is. It's very difficult for HMCTS managers, for example, to manage the situation, and managers themselves may be in self-isolation or working from home, making it very difficult to supervise and manage those staff who are in the buildings. Leadership judges similarly are in that situation vis-a-vis their judicial colleagues. So it's an ever-changing situation, and particular parts of the system on any particular day may be more adversely affected than other parts.
Than others. Understand. Shona, what about the operational side of how the tribunals handle new and ongoing claims? What are the challenges to the existing system?
Well, as Brian has already indicated, obviously, many of the officers are operating on a skeleton staff. But that having been said, the staff that we do have been working incredibly hard across Scotland, England and Wales. The staff are operating on a rota basis. The officers may have reduced hours. So, for example, they may close at 4 o'clock rather than the normal 5 p.m. There are a number of constraints, but that having been said, across Britain, claims are still being served. I checked the position this morning, for example, in Scotland, and I was told that they are just missing their 5-day target, much to their annoyance. The expectation normally is within 5 days of receipt of a claim form, it will be served on the respondent, and they're just missing that. So that, I think, speaks volumes for the staff in those offices that despite these trying circumstances, they're even anywhere near meeting that target. So claims are still being served. I think that we are in a very fortunate position in the Employment Tribunal in having the online submission portal for claims, which obviously operated prior to the COVID pandemic very well. And even before the pandemic, we had slightly over 90% of our claims would come in through that online portal, which of course remains available to people. So that is a very good way, I think, of claims coming into the system without anybody having to put themselves in a position of risk in terms of issuing the claim. We can still continue to accept claims by post and indeed by hand delivery. I don't imagine there will be many people who will be hand delivering to employment tribunal offices at the moment, but I suppose there are key workers out there who have legitimate reason to be out and about and who might choose that as a means of delivering their claim. But we expect the vast majority of claims to come in online, and that is what is happening. We're still serving claims across the country on respondents. If we have an email address, then we will serve the claim on a respondent by email. But of course, we don't always have that. The only way we would have it is if the claimant has specified it on the claim form. And that perhaps is one of the first tips for representatives who may be listening to this, which is if you are the person drafting the claim form and you know the email address of the respondent, then put the email address on the claim form, because that will maximise the chance that we will be able to serve that claim in a way which will be, mean that it will be received within a reasonable space of time. We do have a number of requests that have come in from representatives who act for many big organisations asking us to serve claims by email, and we have been doing that where they have provided the information. We also have some received some requests from organisations, large organisations, asking us to serve centrally at an email address. And what we're tending to do there is, because the rules state that we should serve on the address which is provided to us by the claimant, we will serve on the address provided by the claimant, but copy to the email address which is provided in the request that's come from, as I say, it's mostly larger respondents who are doing that. We're still managing across the country to do a large amount of what we call, in a rather old-fashioned way, still probably interlocutory work. So the judge's duty work, the case management behind the scenes, if you like. We have across Britain rotas of judges who are going into the staffed and open offices to do the incoming work, case management work. And on top of that, we have many of the judges who are working at home remotely also doing our case management or interlocutory work. The staff in the offices, in my experience, and through the feedback I'm getting from judges, are doing an excellent job in providing very good referrals to the judges who are at home, and attaching to those referrals by email documents that have come in by email, or if they've come in the post, they're scanning the documents where they can and sending them to the judges at home. The judges then, if they need more information, can go back to the office staff and say, will you take a look in the file, please, and check X or Y. And I checked last week with the duty judges for Scotland and the staff to say, is there any part of the interlocutory or case management work, paperwork, that we haven't been able to deal with remotely and through the provision of the duty judge rota? And the answer came back clearly from the judges and from the staff, no. That they, in fact, are finding ways to deal with everything that needs to be dealt with, which is tremendously, I think, encouraging. Obviously, in some instances, we've got cases where we may have single judge management of the case, which has been in place prior to the remote working. And so we've got a single judge managing a case from beginning to end, particularly if it's a complex case, where that's the position. Those judges, even if they're not the duty judges, are obviously dealing with referrals in their own, if you like, cases. And that is very useful because, generally speaking, those judges know their own cases like the back of their hands, even if they don't have the file immediately before them. So we're making use of that too. And obviously we're doing what we can to conduct hearings by telephone or case management hearings by telephone. And I think through the presidential guidance that we've issued, ELA members will be able to understand what it is that we're trying to achieve there. So far, we have been able to, across the country, to fix quite a significant number of telephone case management hearings. And I think it's important that we're clear about this. Brian and I both see this as the starter, if you like, for 10, the opportunity to discuss with representatives and parties what it is that we can possibly achieve to ensure that, as far as we possibly can, the administration of justice continues as effectively as possible during these unprecedented circumstances. And where we can, although the backstop initially was fix the telephone case management hearing for the first day of the substantive hearing that had been fixed, where we can, we will bring forward those hearings in time, those telephone case management hearings, so that if it transpires that parties are pretty much ready to go and want to go ahead on a remote basis, or indeed to try to resolve matters through judicial mediation, then we will be doing our best to get those cases back into the space that we now have in the lists so that we can progress those to a determination or a mediated settlement as quickly as we possibly can. So we rely, of course, on the staff to help us to fix these case management hearings, but I think it would be, generally speaking, pretty much across the country, so far, so good with that. Brian, I don't know if you have anything, again, you'd want to add to that.
I think the only thing to pick up is that the challenge for us as leadership judges is how do we get those cases into the list and by what method for hearing, where the parties are of the view that there's going to be contested evidence, for example, or numerous witnesses. So these are the longer hearings, Nick, that you and your colleagues will all know about, that require 5 or 10 or 15 days of hearing allocation. What we're finding through the telephone case management hearings is that many of the parties are saying, look, we would rather we waited until the pandemic crisis is over and have these cases relisted for an in-person hearing. And if that is the view, that's the view which we will also take. We're interested in ensuring that the overriding objective is observed. For shorter cases, if the parties are interested in remote hearing technology, we will certainly seriously consider doing that. And at the moment, whilst we're primarily using Skype for Business, Microsoft Teams, and potentially Zoom, in the longer term, we're looking to use a platform which is a cloud-based video platform called Kinley, and that will be supported by HMCTS. So the real challenge is how do we deal with those longer cases, and an associated challenge is how do we ensure that where a public hearing is required, a public hearing is delivered.
Yes, I can see that's a particular challenge. And just following up on that technology question, thinking about claimants who want a case to go ahead, who it's a short case, they are in principle happy to do it by video technology. Is that technology available, made available at no cost to the claimant? That may be a very obvious question, but I've always wondered quite how that would work.
In most cases, it just requires a Wi-Fi connection, so very easily done using home broadband. But of course, not all claimants, particularly litigants in person, will have access to that, and we have to take that into account. But in principle, apart from the overhead of having a home broadband or Wi-Fi system, there should be no obvious cost.
And I think it follows from that that the tribunals are now doing, I'll call them final hearings, remotely over video technology, or is that something that is, even for the shorter cases where the parties are in favour, you're working towards that, but that hasn't yet happened?
I think we have got some examples of final hearings being conducted. So though kind of cases that we call short track cases, unpaid wages claims, perhaps involving no more than an hour or so, we already have some examples of those being conducted remotely. It's the longer cases, cases for a day or more, where we don't yet have much experience or examples that we can illustrate the use of remote technology. And I think that's where there's still work to be done. There is no point in trying to achieve too much before we actually have everything in place.
Shona, what's your perspective on things?
I agree with what Brian has said, and for me the absolutely backstop position is the overriding objective. We have to deal with cases fairly and justly. If it's not fair and just, if it's not going to result in a fair and just hearing, then to my mind, unfortunate though it is, then there will have to be a delay in the hearing of the case. I think that, as Brian has mentioned, we are at a stage with video technology where, for the judges, they are on a very steep learning curve. Although use of video platforms was something that was envisaged more generally through the HMCTS reform programme in the longer term, no one quite expected, certainly in the employment tribunal world, that we would be...
Crash testing it
is perhaps the best way of putting it. As somebody said the other day in producing new equipment, this is crash, bang, wallop. And that's where we're at. But the judges really are trying their best. Brian's mentioned Kinley, and that might be a very useful platform, particularly when we start to think about unrepresented parties who may be... have an internet connection, but are rather reluctant, perhaps, and perhaps understandably, to start to download programs like Skype or Microsoft Teams, which we have access to. But the Kinley platform, which is being devised by the Ministry of Justice as a cloud-based platform, and was for the HMCTS reform program on the stocks, if you like, but they have pushed it forward. Because it's cloud-based, it simply needs the access to the internet. It doesn't require the parties to download some specific programme. And I think that that's quite useful. Cardiff and Glasgow have been given Kinley licences, room licences, last week to trial. So we've currently got judges in Cardiff and in Glasgow who are being trained in Kinley, who are keenly hearing themselves talking to each other to try it out. But that certainly, I think, may be a very useful platform because it has been devised specifically with conducting hearings in mind.
Right. And just final question on this, and I'll move on, because I find this fascinating, because you're watching a system evolve in high speed right in front of you, and you are helping the evolution take place. You mentioned, of course, hearings need to be public. So is the tribunal register now including details of how interested bystanders can log in and watch hearings taking place?
If I said that Brian and I have lost sleep over a particular issue, it's that issue, perhaps. This is really important and not easy in the employment tribunal's context. What we're hoping to do, we have been looking at the restrictions that are imposed by the legislation, the protection of health regulations, which are slightly different, but to the same object, have the same objective in Scotland, England, and in Wales. And we can see that there may well be a difficulty in suggesting that the public are entitled to come into employment tribunal hearing offices and to sit and watch a hearing, whether that's on a video screen or listen to it through a telephone, because there is a very big debate about whether that's a necessary journey that one would have made to do that. So we're having to look at what's possible in terms of individuals, including members of the press, being able to join into video enabled hearings or telephone enabled hearings. And that is a work in progress. But one of the things that we're now looking at is how do we advertise the access that may be possible through into a video hearing or a telephone hearing through the use of our cause lists, which are published on the web. So if we can make information available there, to the press and indeed a member of the public to say that if you wish to access this hearing, which is a public hearing, here is what you have to do, then that will obviously be a significant step. And we hope to be able to achieve that relatively quickly. Obviously, there are systems, video systems, and indeed the telephone hearing system, which records the hearing as it is taking place. But I think it would be a moot point, in my view, as to whether a hearing that is recorded and then simply available to listen to would count as a public hearing in the sense required by the rules of procedure. But the use of recording technology might be part of solution, but it's certainly not the whole solution. And finally, Kinley will have, within the next 2 weeks, we hope, video streaming technology involved. But question mark over what controls one would have to have in place before one would have a situation where one was video streaming an employment tribunal hearing. And again, Brian and I are spending a lot of time, this pandemic, if it's been good for one thing, there was always good cross-border relations, but every single day, Brian and I are talking about many things, and this is one of them. So we're working quite hard to try to make sure that we can provide public access to hearings, because again, I don't think that's something on which we think there is a huge scope to compromise.
I understand. And I could, even just listening to you speaking, I'm thinking, what do you do? The fact you can't record hearings then becomes entirely a matter of trust, because if you can dial in on a laptop or something, how can you stop that being recorded? What do you do about making bundles and pleadings and witness statements available to people? And you can see that if you're a party to a tribunal hearing, the idea that your witness statements now need to go out online and be freely available to all, it's a very different thing from saying, well, someone who comes to a tribunal can watch and be given a physical copy of something. Brian, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add to that.
Well, I think it's important to stress that comparisons with what is possible in the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeal, or the Technology Court are simply not apt, really. On any given day in Scotland, England and Wales, there's probably 150 employment tribunals sitting. So the idea that we would be able to stream live from 150 different tribunals just really doesn't bear comparison to what is currently being done in the Court of Appeal and in the Supreme Court, where you're talking about two or three hearing rooms being live streamed from. And the challenges that we face, of course, is that we are not starting from a position whereby, unlike the courts, our hearings are automatically recorded.
Of course.
So that is an additional problem, which is not to say that these problems can't be overcome, but practitioners need to understand that we are starting from a quite different position than many of our colleagues in the courts are starting from. And we're also a first instance fact-finding forum, yes, which is entirely different from an appellate forum.
And indeed, of course, designed to be used by individuals without legal representation. So yes, again, it's a completely different atmosphere. I mean, one of the pleasures of having trainees is you introduce them to the High Court and you introduce them to the Tribunal Court system, and they're like chalk and cheese, just the atmosphere, the approach, everything. I wonder if we move on. Looking at the challenges we've talked about, you've mentioned presidential guidance. We know there's the FAQ and the directions document. What is being done for the tribunals, for tribunal judges, for the users to assist them in adapting to what is quite a very fast moving situation? First of all, Brian, say the presidential guidance, the direction, the practice direction, the FAQs, how are these intended to operate and what is the focus for each of them?
So we, Shona and I, have collaborated to produce quite quickly in the current crisis three key judicial documents: the First being the presidential guidance, which is very much directed to parties, whether represented or not, and encouraging them to think alongside the judges very imaginatively about what might be possible as the means for resolving the dispute between them, whether that means taking the matter to a final hearing or whether it means using alternative dispute resolution, the narrowing of the issues, neutral evaluation of the case, whatever means is possible. The presidential direction is designed to clear the decks so that both staff and judiciary and indeed parties have a period which is initially 3 months in which they know that all in-person hearings have been postponed and in their place telephone case management hearings have been inserted with the intention of exploring with the parties how best to proceed. And we have put some review points into that direction so that the parties will know that we are actively considering how long that 3 month postponement of cases is likely to be in place. And then the most recent document, which is the frequently asked questions document, is our response really to the questions that are being asked of us. Both Shona and I are fielding directly and indirectly every day lots of questions which are coming from parties and practitioners and professional associations. So the FAQs, which is a living document, one which we imagine we will update regularly, is designed to try and provide some guidance and some answers to the frequently asked questions.
Shona, just picking up on that, is there anything in those three documents that you would particularly wish to flag up for practitioners, let's say, either advice, caution, or do's and don'ts? Is there anything in those documents that you feel is particularly important?
I think if one looks at, for example, the presidential guidance, one of the things that we mentioned quite near the beginning, I think in paragraph 3, is we're operating under various constraints. And we have to be realistic about that. This isn't a business as usual situation and we can't provide business as usual. So bear in mind those constraints. We don't have access across the country on a uniform basis to all of the technology that we might want to have, for example. And we don't have across the country necessarily all that many staff in all that many offices, for example, and we tried to explain that in the presidential guidance. So I suppose it's something about bearing with us as we try to navigate this. At various points throughout that guidance, what we tried to do was to encourage represented parties in particular to cooperate with each other. And indeed, our final note, I think perhaps paragraph 21 in the presidential guidance, is almost a plea to parties to ask them, or to representatives, to say, cooperate. Now, the overriding objective, of course, requires parties and representatives to cooperate. But you know, Nick, and the people listening to this know, as do Brian and I, that cooperation is not something that is always a hallmark of employment tribunal proceedings. But when we say cooperate this time, we really do mean it. So what we want you to try to do is really using the presidential guidance and any other documents that we issue is, for example, to try to get as much agreed as you possibly can if we are to even have a go, if you like, at hearing a case remotely. It would make a huge difference if as much evidence as possible is set out in agreed statements of facts. Try to reduce the number of documents. All three of us, and many of the listeners, no doubt, have sat through employment tribunal hearings where they have been faced with huge bundles of documents. And what one finds is that perhaps a tenth of the documents are actually referred to in the hearing. So be careful as you can, I think, in identifying what documents that are really needed for the hearing, because as you say, the ability to actually display documents and consider them, it's not the same if one was using video than if one was using or one had an in-person hearing. So for me, the presidential guidance is critical in trying to push that issue of please cooperate in a way that you perhaps have never cooperated before in your professional life, but do it this time, because at the end of the day, what's important, I think, is the effective administration of justice as far as we can possibly achieve that. And as professionals, as lawyers, as barristers, advocates in Scotland and as judges, I think that is something that is fundamental and should be to the way in which we go about our business. So that for me would be very important. There's also a number of other, what shall we say, hints and tips that come out across the various documents that we're issuing. And I think the frequently asked questions has a number of hints and tips, if you like, built in. And so we say, for example, only email or phone an office if you really need to. It's not business as usual. We've not got the staff that we normally have. Use email as a main method of communication when you do need to communicate with us. I've already mentioned, if you're submitting a claim form, put the respondent's email address if you know it, and then that will help us with service and other communication. One of the other things that I think that would also be important, and we, if you like, touch on this in the frequently asked questions, is make sure that we have up-to-date contact information. Many of you are working from home. We understand that. But you may have submitted a claim form or a response form in which the telephone number you gave us was the telephone number of your office. Your office may be closed. Mm. So it's very important, if you are emailing the tribunal office, that you also say, if it's not the number you gave us on the claim or response form, you say, actually, please, can you update my records? Here is the telephone number that you will get me at. So it's things like that that will help us all to keep going in these difficult situations. Also, I think we say in the frequently asked questions, if something is urgent and you're emailing about it, mark urgent in the header of the email. But please, and I trust you all on this, say it's urgent. If it really is urgent, don't think I'll mark it as urgent to get ahead of the queue. That wouldn't.
I'm important, therefore it's urgent.
Exactly. So I think the other thing that we've tried to encourage in both the frequently asked questions and the presidential guidance is try to see things from the perspective of the other party in the case. Difficult though that may be. You might, as a professional representative, have your case very well prepped, able to answer lots of questions, able to identify ways in which you can make progress, able to provide answers to any kinds of orders that the tribunal might issue. Not everybody is in that position. If you're an unrepresented claimant, for example, and you were getting help from a university law clinic or the Citizens Advice Bureau, you might no longer have even access to that kind of advice. If you are someone who's a claimant in a situation where the respondent's office has been closed and you don't know how to contact anyone anymore, you might have real difficulty in getting access to the information that you need to be able to make progress in your case. You might have real problems in finding your witnesses who are no longer at the place that you thought they were at, or perhaps they are self-isolating and for various reasons not able to talk to you at all about your case. So bear in mind whatever your own position is in the litigation, the other side may not be in that, what may be a fortunate position on your side. And so we're trying to, I suppose, encourage people to look at the case, bearing in mind the difficulties that everybody, not just the tribunal system itself, but everybody involved in the proceedings may be facing.
Brian, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add to that. I must say that my take, I read paragraph, the last paragraph of the Prudential Guidance, and actually, I find it a little bit moving because, you know, it's a bit like the stay inside advice. It's be a good citizen here, help us, you know, don't be whatever the negative term is you want to use. Anyway, Brian, is there anything you wanted to add around the Presidential Guidance and the FAQs? Anything else that for you stands out particularly in addition to what Shona has been saying?
A short point, if I may, Nick, which is that I think that the current emergency situation will bring out the best in alternative dispute resolution. Both sides of the border, we're seeing a willingness to enter into judicial mediation, and judicial mediations being conducted, actually, in many cases, in a shorter time frame than would normally be the case because of the use of remote technology. And in England and Wales, where we also have a protocol on judicial assessment or early neutral evaluation, I think that this might be the moment where an underused facility might well come into its own. So we're looking for various ways in which we can resolve the dispute, and alternative dispute resolution, I think, has come to the fore.
Fascinating. I wanted to ask briefly, I understand digital training has also been, there's a digital training programme being put in place. Brian, do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, clearly we can't do face-to-face training with our judges on the conduct of remote hearings and the use of technology. But on both sides of the border, the employment tribunals are already in the vanguard of using e-training methods, digital methods of training our colleagues. And some very good material has already been produced, in particular in respect of the use of Skype and the use of Teams. And similarly, online training is well advanced in respect of the use of the new Kindley system.
Fascinating. I wanted to sort of build on what we were saying, and you were talking about discussions taking place and input into say, how online full hearings could take place. Is there a sort of focus group or similar operating between the tribunals to share solutions, tips, knowledge, whatever else? I think it sounds as if lots of people are doing a lot of learning in short order, and so you may have people encountering similar problems in different parts of the Great Britain. So, Brian, is there a focus group or something similar operating to pool knowledge and develop guidance going forward?
There's many layers to this, really. I mean, both Shona and I are in regular contact with each other. Shona also has the support of her vice president, Susan Walker. I have 10 regional employment judges with whom I have regular meetings during the week. I also got my successor who takes over from me as president in May. That's Barry Clark. And he and I are in the handover period and we're working very closely together. And Shona and I are also liaising with the president of the Industrial Tribunals and Fair Employment Tribunal in Northern Ireland, Eileen McBride. So within the employment tribunal system, there is some very good dialogue going on between the leadership judges. We're also in what I hope is regular and good contact with the users and stakeholders. This podcast is one example of that. I am also in contact with the Specialist Employment Law Bar Association in England and Wales. We have contact with our respective national user groups. But even more significantly, we're part of the Senior President of Tribunals leadership team. And the Senior President of Tribunals, Sir Ernest Ryder, is taking a real lead in how the tribunals are reacting to the emergency situation. And there is regular dialogue between the presidents of the various chambers of the first tier Tribunal and the Upper Tribunal, and the two Employment Tribunals and the Employment Appeal Tribunal. So considerable work being done, and considerable work being done by individual judges to whom we've delegated lead responsibilities. Each of us on both sides of the border have judges who take particular responsibility for things like training or IT, for example.
Fascinating, fascinating. Shona, anything from your perspective?
I think Brian's given you the big picture at that strategic level. And as he's indicated, beneath that level, we have a lot of judges who are working together to produce hints and tips. So judges who, for one reason or another, whether it's because of their experience in practice or for some other reason, they're judges who are familiar with, or more familiar than average, with new technology, let's say, video platforms and what they can and can't do. And they have been working together on a cross-border basis to provide support for the rest of us who are getting up to speed with that. So that has been very beneficial, producing written guidance, which we are sharing, and there are a number of options for guidance to be placed in various places, shall I put it like that, which judges have access to. So on Microsoft Teams, there are share facilities, lots of material developing there. We have Judicial SharePoint within our e-judiciary system, lots of material going on there that all judges can access help them cope with the challenges that they face. And below that, one of the things that has encouraged me is judges simply taking the time to talk to each other. Mm. So, for example, I know that, for example, this morning there was a discussion for 28 minutes and 44 seconds on Microsoft Teams, which is, it comes under the label of Glasgow Coffee Room, but it's actually all judges, employment judges in Scotland, coffee room discussion. So at the normal time when judges would have been meeting if they were in person, you can go into that discussion, video discussion, and you can have the same kind of chat or as near as possible that you would have had at the start of the day about what your cases might be, issues that you think might be difficult to deal with, whatever it is. You can have that discussion and really just get a bit of support and comfort from your judicial colleagues. So that has been very encouraging, and I didn't set that in motion. The judges themselves did that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Good. Well, just picking up on that question I wanted to ask about future guidance. We were talking a few minutes ago that the FAQ document might be updated from time to time if other points become apparent. Are you envisaging further presidential guidance coming out in the next month or two? Or is it very much wait and see as it comes up?
Well, I think there are two possibilities. I won't put a particular time frame on them, but two possibilities. One is that Shona and I will be looking to see whether we need to update or amend the presidential guidance, the presidential directions, or the FAQs. That will be an ongoing process. But secondly, once we are rolling out the Kindly platform, that I think is very likely to be the opportunity for us to issue specific guidance aimed at both judges and users at what we expect in terms of the conduct and indeed etiquette of remote hearings and the use of the technology. So I would imagine that that will be the fourth document that we are likely to issue, but there is no point in issuing that prematurely.
I understand. Shona, from your point of view, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think Brian's absolutely right that it's tempting sometimes in these situations to issue document after document, but that sometimes leads to confusion. So we need to sometimes think, do I really need to issue this? And if I do, is this the best time to issue it, or should I wait, particularly when things are changing on a daily basis on certain aspects of what we're doing? But I think, as Brian says, the Kinley platform and how it can be put to best use will be something that we will put pen to paper on, or an electronic pen to electronic paper in due course. And indeed, because Glasgow is one of the lead offices for that, there are three judges, the Vice President and two others, who are actually at the moment beginning to draft outline guidance on using Kinley for representatives, parties, judges, and so on. But we're not there yet, obviously, but that's in the making.
Fantastic. And I think, dare I say it, there are a number of law firms that could do with your comment about, do I need to issue a document? Having seen these slew of coronavirus advice that's going out on a daily basis from most law firms, I think I have a theory that if law firms had to plant trees for each piece of paper they used, we'd see a lot less paper, electronic or otherwise. Anyway. So thank you. If I could close, and Shona, I don't know if Brian has warned you of this, but I'd like to end with a question that's perhaps less directly focused on the tribunal system and its current challenges. I tend to close guest podcasts with a request for a recommendation for a book or a film or a piece of music or something similar that you'd recommend and why. And I thought I'd adapt that slightly for this podcast by saying, bearing in mind in these challenging times, is there anything you'd both like to recommend as helping to sustain you personally during this period and why? And that can be anything. It doesn't need to be limited to a work of art. Shona, do you want to go first?
Oh, well, now, I am a great reader as it happens. Right. And my first degree before I did law, I studied English literature and particularly American literature. And I remain fond of novels in particular. So one of the things that I do, on the vast majority of evenings, I will read at least one or two chapters of a book. I'm currently reading Sebastian Barry's The Secret Scripture, which I'm very much enjoying. And that just takes me into another world. And I need that because otherwise I would be worrying too much about what's going on. And the second thing that I particularly enjoy is cooking and baking. I have had very little time to bake. I've been too busy doing writing all these documents with Brian, but certainly a little bit of cooking is good for the soul. My husband's a hospital doctor, so he's coming home from the front line, and it does him good and it does me good if I know that he's having something reasonable for his supper. So I'm spending a little bit of time doing that.
Well, that's lovely and real support. And it does make me think that we ought to run a future podcast, which is recipes recommended by tribunal judges. I think that would be a smash. Brian, how about you? What would you be recommending?
Well, my eldest daughter and her husband and our two grandchildren have been in self-isolation for a period of time. And so I've got my daily exercise routine, because they only live about a mile away from us, is to walk up once a day with some sort of surprise for the two grandchildren and something which my wife has prepared for their tea.
Oh, lovely.
I'm sort of reminded of the podcast you did with me 2 years ago, in which you asked me at the end for my desert island discs. And just thinking about that perhaps I ought to do my daily exercise listening to Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks or something by Bruce Springsteen or Joni Mitchell, as I told you about in that podcast.
Exactly. Well, if you like Blood on the Tracks, can I recommend More Blood, More Tracks, which is everything that was recorded in those sessions? It's fabulous from start to finish.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Well, listen, I think it only remains to say thank you very much indeed. That's genuinely been fascinating and I've learned a lot. I hope it was fun to do on your part too. But I'm forever going to think of the tribunal process and what you're going through now as Project Crash Bang Wallop. I think that's the way to do it. But thank you very much, both of you. And We really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Jack.